Session number 20367, Reel 2.
Brigadier Ryan, Reel 2.
My next memories were just before the Commonwealth Division came back into the line, and that was the what we regarded as something extremely ordinary, but the Americans didn't, was the our ability to put down fire in support of our supported battalions or companies. The Royal Artillery, and indeed the Commonwealth Artilleries in support of the Commonwealth Division, were all on a regimental net. That is to say, all the gun batteries and all the OPs were on the same net with the commanding officer and the battery commanders. The regiments were on a rear link net to HQRA and to the headquarters of the Commonwealth Division. The medium battery was also on the RA command net from HQRA. And if the company commander with whom you were living said, I've got a sticky problem in front of me, I don't think I should be able to extricate my standing patrol because there appear to be one or two platoons of Chinese just in front of them or holding them, pinning them down, can you help? Because of Commonwealth Division artillery procedures, which were really UK procedures, we could order fire, we were authorised, in other words, and bring it down just where the company commander wanted it. Now, we used to do this on, if it was a registered DF target, and most of them were, we could sometimes did this at night in 60 seconds. Our record was 44 seconds from scratch. And the battery commander behind me and the CO behind him went with my request and didn't and didn't gainsay it. And therefore, our response to request for fire seemed to Americans miraculous. Now, their system was quite different. They tended to have quite junior officers, second lieutenants or sergeants in the OP. And if a similar situation hit them, the young officer or sergeant would radio back or telephone back to the fire direction centre of the American battalion and request fire. And there, the battalion exec or the duty officer would consider it, possibly clear it with the commanding officer, who was also in the command post, and then fire would come down. Now, this might take several minutes to do. It could take as long as 15 minutes. So, for this, the Americans thought was marvellous, the way they could not only call upon my battery for fire, but I could call upon the fire, if it was necessary, of the whole divisional artillery. And I would be likely to get that in 4 or 5 minutes, which would be 72 guns plus the medium battery. They couldn't do anything like this in that sort of time. So they thought that was a tremendous boon. I know they came to watch it several times. I believe their opinion was that the cunning Brits in some way were cheating, and they couldn't quite work out how. I believe it was our system of keeping fairly senior gunners forward and quite junior gunners in command posts or fire direction centres. And so the battle was fought, by as far as the gunners were concerned, forward and not back. And that was something I think that came as a shock to me that other people didn't do this, because I hadn't had any experience with Americans before. And I think came as a rather sort of warm glow, and we were able to provide this at short notice. And then it was about that time, I suppose, and I can't remember when it was, but it can't have been too much after that, that the Commonwealth Division moved back into the line. And for a short time, I found myself still on point 131, but this time in the middle of a Canadian battalion, and I think this would be 2nd or 3rd RCR, Royal Canadian Regiment. I'm sorry I can't remember which, they changed over about that time. And they had a sort of ambivalent feelings about defence. I think they had grown, since the end of the war, they'd grown slightly towards the Americans in their tactical thinking. I didn't say wholly, but slightly. And so they adopted the equivalent of the outpost line of resistance again, took it over from the Netherlands battalion, and they too, while I was up in the OP, had another one of those nasty occasions when the OPLR platoon was attacked and overrun by Chinese, and they lost 12 or so dead. And I can remember them being collected and placed in white half tracks, and the bonnet of the half track covered with the Canadian flag. It was very sobering. I think it was the first time I'd actually seen dead soldiers in any quantity. I think up till then I must have seen an odd one, but I don't really remember them. These were a large number of Canadian soldiers, all dead, shot, bayoneted probably. And then the other troop commander in the battery, who was a bit younger than me, terribly nice, and what turned out to be a highly efficient officer called Dick Trant, and very much more promoted than I ever was. He and I boxed and coxed in the OPs, so that normally one of us was up in the OP and one was down, doing 10-day stints, with a half day off in the middle to have a bath, or to have a shower, actually, when our GPOs would relieve us for an afternoon, usually midday till evening. And this went on pretty well for the rest of the time we were in Korea. And we shuttled across. We weren't always on 0.31. I did one or two sessions on the hook, which is on the left of our Commonwealth Division sector. I did one session on 0.355, which is on the right of our divisional sector. And I did then one or two sessions at a brand new divisional OP that we dug for the CRA, and that was called the divisional OP or the CRA's OP, and was dug on point, I think, 187. I'm not absolutely certain of this. We always refer to it as OP15 because that was its call sign on the HQRA command net. And this was a masterpiece of digging, not dug by me, mostly dug by the other troop commander, Dick Trant, and parties of 20 or 30 men at a time, only digging at night. By day, they dug a tunnel about 100 feet through the hill from the company command post on the reverse slope of the hill, shoring it up like a mine as they went through. And then when they got close to the front of the hill, they went up onto the hill only by night and dug down a great hole, joined the hole to the tunnel, put a roof over the hole, and then unmasked the OP by digging out the front of it on the last night. And this was an OP, instead of as our normal OPs were, with perhaps a slit like that, this had a slit of over 180 degrees, so you could see a great wide panorama of the entire divisional front.
Instead of being a straight slit,
it was a great big semicircular one, reinforced all the way, but by looking left and right you could see the back of the hook and the back of 355 and all the Chinese ground in front of you, from a good height too. 0.187 was a good height, and that was used as not as an operational OP, but as a demonstration OP by the GOC and by the CRA, but mostly by the GOC, who by that time was General West, M.M. Alston Roberts West, who was a great chap, and still Peter Gregson as the CRA. And they would bring visitors of all sorts. I can remember Americans, Commonwealth Division, Commonwealth generals, politicians, eminent newspaper men, a naval officer on one occasion. And the aim was to bring them up into the OP and invite the principal guest to point out anything on our front that he would like engaged. And to make sure there was no mistake, he did it with a little parallel pointer called a pointer's battery staff, which consisted of two rods with a sight at each end on a swivel that turned it round and raised it up and down. And the chap who wanted to indicate the target would swivel this thing round until it pointed precisely at a hill or a re-entrant or a valley or something. One hoped on the enemy's side, otherwise you had to stop it. And then the observing officer, who was often me, sometimes Dick Trant, would engage this point without ranging. The theory being that we knew our front so well, our map reading was so good by that time, because we'd been there a long while, that we could engage virtually any point on the divisional front, going straight to rounds of fire for effect. And this was really a most spectacular exercise, because the divisional artillery was always warned off for these occasions, and so they were ready. But as the OP officer, I would send down the orders, uncle target, uncle target, uncle target, meaning a divisional target. I'd give them a grid reference, a height, and a direction from the OP, an OT line as it was called, and I would say, scale one, fire by order, which means one round from every gun in the division, and fired when I tell them to fire. The aim of this being, of course, that everything came down at the same time. And so the skill was that as I passed the last element of the order down, and the orders were passed in slices and acknowledged by each regiment concerned on the RA command net, if everybody was on their toes, then by the time I passed the last chunk of orders down, the senior regiment on the net would report ready. They had done this, in other words, in something like 30 or 40 seconds, the time it took to transmit the orders in packets, backwards and forwards, between the guns and the OP. This was always very impressive to foreign visitors. The proof was, of course, though, that I then sucked my breath in, crossed my fingers, and said, fire, and 72 guns came down and 8 medium rounds came down, roughly speaking, not in the same hole, but in the same parish. I used to order concentrate, and it meant that we probably got the divisional artillery down in an area of 100 yards by 100 yards, which was quite an impressive display. And then they'd immediately give me another target. Sometimes they'd give me two targets at the same time, one there, one there. I'd engage one, switch to the other, and engage the other. This was all a party trick, really. But it depended on the gunners being on their toes at the other end, and it depended on me giving the right grid reference to how to. I only failed totally, absolutely once. And it all went swimmingly, and I said fire, and the shells went overhead. There was a boom, 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 and we didn't see a single thing. And I said to the CRA, well, you know, some you lose and some you win. But I think I know what's happened to that lot. They're 1,000 yards too far back. I just misread the map or misread the ground or something like that. And he said, never mind, you can't win them all. So mostly, the only failure I had, I think. And we did other things like that. From that OP, for example, on the morning of the Queen's coronation, which was the 2nd of June 1953, I ranged the field regiments on three prominent enemy hills and then fired at 11 o'clock in the morning concentrations of red, white and blue smoke to order. This was at 11 o'clock and the CRA said to me, he said, keep the targets well up because the Chinese will like to see that as well. I didn't know they thought too much of white and blue smoke coming down in their backyards, but it was a marvellous concentration, looked absolutely super, three great enormous clouds of red, white and blue smoke. And that was followed by all nine infantry battalions starting from the left, standing up in their dugouts and trenches and firing a feu de joie from the left to the right in honour of the Queen. Quite something to do, that. Imagine nine battalions doing this. I remember watching it rippled all the way down the front. It wasn't perfect. You know, sometimes there was a gap between one lot firing and the next lot starting. And they gave then three cheers to Her Majesty. And that was the end of operations for the day.
And then
it was about that time that the first rumblings of peace, or the truce, not peace, the truce started. And actually before that, and either side of that, there were some very nasty battles. There was the first Hook battle and the second Hook battle. The second one was in May, 28th, 29th, something like that of May, end of May. And then there was another one in July, I think. I can't remember the dates, I'm afraid. And although the truce was on or coming, these were battles, I think, by the Chinese to capture really dominant positions in our line, because they wanted to be on those dominant positions when the truce line was decided. And we didn't lose an inch. And we didn't lose a lot of men either, but the Chinese lost an enormous amount of men on both of those occasions. And I remember on the second occasion, I was acting as battery captain, who was really the quartermaster of the battery, because the battery captain had gone on leave to Hong Kong. And I wasn't very skilled in being a battery captain, never been one. And in the middle of the battle, I was sent down from the battery position with all the matadors, the gun-towing vehicles, to bring up shells, charges and fuses. And the fuses we wanted were the airburst fuses called VT fuses, variable time fuses. Now these were fuses that we'd had at the end of World War II, and they worked, I'm not quite sure how they worked, a little radio transmitter or something in them that detonated the fuse a fixed distance above the ground. So the problem that you'd have with the old clockwork fuses of trying to estimate where the gun shell should go off were done away with. And I was sent down to get supplies of rounds, plugged rounds, plus VT fuses. And I went down to the ammunition point and I said, where are the VT fuses? And they said, over there, that last bay. And I confess I made a slight mistake. The only VT fuse I'd ever heard of were T-97, which was the VT fuse for 25-pounder. They were, in fact, the VT fuses for 5.5s were called T-100. So I brought back the wrong fuses. They fitted the shells, and we fired them. And I said to the BC early next morning, I'm terribly sorry, I brought you the wrong fuses. So the shells, instead of going off 100 feet above the ground on the Hook, would have gone off 25 feet above the ground. And he said, bloody good, they go off too high anyway. But I did learn a lesson there. Yeah, I had to learn a bit more about ammunition before I did battery captain again. Then, we were then into this period of truce and ceasefire, and I've forgotten the date of the ceasefire, but it was something like July, I think. And there were quite a lot of nasty little actions during that period. One I particularly remember was an attack against the Turkish brigade, who were on the Commonwealth Division left. And because the 5.5 battery, 74 battery, had the range, I went over to them as an LO, in other words, an OP officer but not in an OP, in order to bring fire to bear on their front if they were attacked by Chinese. And they were, and we did, and the fire was very effective. And we did the same thing for the ROC division, the ROK division, which was on the Commonwealth Division right. The field regiments couldn't reach across there, but the medium battery could. It only did it, incidentally, by doing a thing you don't normally have to do in a fixed position war, where you're dug into a big pit. You have, where you're normally, your arc of fire is about 60 degrees, to enable us to fire on the two extremities of the front, we were doing switches of 100 degrees. That's an enormous switch across the front, which meant you had to bring the trails up, move the gun round, and bury the trails again. We were doing that the same night from one side of the front to the other. It was quite an operation of war, but we managed it because we were prepared for it. So I remember that going on. The other thing I remember, we ran short of... Our fighting range, because of our distance behind the main line, which had to be a certain fixed distance in order that we could reach out round the whole front, which was bow-shaped, really, we had to be about, from memory, 8,000 yards behind the front line, something of that order, or the front area. And therefore, we were firing a charge, which was, I think, charge 2. I'm not absolutely certain of this, but charge 2. And we weren't firing the charges 3 and 4, or charge 1. And so at a certain stage in that period, we ran out of, and the ammunition supply system ran out of 5.5 charge 2s. So our battery commander, Major Batten, borrowed some American 155 charges of a similar nature. We call them green bags, but they were obviously something similar, the 155 being broadly similar to the 5.5, but slightly greater range. We borrowed these and plugged one up behind a 5.5 shell and fired it, and noted that if we added between 600 and 800 yards at the mean fighting range, we would get the same sort of answer. Very rough and ready, I might say. But for about a week, we fired the American green bag charges. We couldn't have done very accurate destructive shoots, and we certainly couldn't have fired close to our own men, because we had no idea how these charges would behave in those sort of circumstances. But in depth fire, we achieved reasonable results. And that was a little drama. We sent a signal back to the School of Artillery telling them what we'd done, they being technically responsible for everything that went on. And we got an anguished signal in return saying, "Do not, under any circumstances, continue with this practice. How will you fill in the gun's life history graph?" This is the thing that showed you how far through its life a gun barrel wear had gone. And every so many equivalent full rounds or full charges that you fired, you had to complete the graph, and then when it came to the end of its useful life, you took the liner out and put a new one in. I don't think the battery commander paid any attention to that. He just went straight on firing them. But fortunately, it was all over. My memories are only about 10 days, and then we were back fresh supplies of ammunition came out from Hong Kong, probably. And so we were saved again.
And they were called green bags?
Well, I thought we called them green bags, but they must have had a special name. The Americans refer to them as green bags. I think they probably had different colours for their charges, and the green bag was the equivalent to ours, whatever it was. They probably was a charge 2-4 or something like that. I'm not sure. I wasn't ever at the gun end, this was the thing. I was always at the OP. Saw the results, but not the technical work at the other end. Now, what happened then? Can we have a break for a moment? Would that be all right? After the truce was signed, the battery pulled back into a position alongside HQRA because we cleared, each of the sides cleared a three-kilometre strip from the contact line in the centre. When that happened, there was the whole problem of prisoners of war. Generally speaking, there were about 25,000 Korean prisoners of war, South Korean prisoners of war. They were about 700 or 800 British prisoners of war, the Commonwealth prisoners of war, who were mostly Brits, mostly the Gloucesters, I think. And there were one or two other odds and ends, not very many. And after the ceasefire had taken effect, prisoners were sent back in two groups. The severely wounded, or the wounded, came back in a thing called Little Switch. And they came back through a peace village which was constructed in the demilitarized zone between the two sides called Panmunjom. And it was at Panmunjom that the two sides met and talked. I'm going to turn that thing off, shall I? So, at Panmunjom, where the two sides dealt with each other. Following Little Switch, Big Switch occurred when the remaining prisoners were repatriated. And as far as the Commonwealth Division were concerned, every prisoner came home bar one, which I'll talk about in a moment. But there were still remaining on the enemy side one Commonwealth prisoner, who was a Marine called Andrew Condren, and 25, I think, American prisoners who all wished to be communists, not come home, plus an undisclosed number, 500 or 600 South Koreans. I'm not quite sure how many. And some, yes, there are 500 or 600 South Koreans. So it was agreed that each side would be given the opportunity to speak to those prisoners who didn't wish to come back and explain to them the benefits of returning home and not staying with the enemy. From our side, this was an organization called the United Nations Command Repatriation and Explainer Group. At the time it was formed, and this was very soon after the peace had been signed, we weren't quite certain how many Brits would want to stay. So the GOC, who was then General Knapp Murray, taken over from General West, decided he would detail two officers in the Commonwealth Division, a very senior Royal Scot called Mike McNab, who had been a prisoner of the Germans from St. Valery onwards in World War II. And I got the second slot. I'm not quite sure why. But the pair of us were nominated. And I remember I was told I could be a local major, which meant that I didn't have any pay, but I could put majors' crowns up. I hadn't gotten any, I didn't know where to get any, but it didn't matter too much. And we were summoned, taken down, went down by AeroP flight, actually, to a place well down in the Korean Peninsula called Taegu, where we did a certain amount of training and explanation about what was going to happen and what we should be doing. And they were about 30 of us, I suppose. They were mostly Americans, but there was a Greek major,